This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Okay, in a few minutes, I am going to be talking to an author whose books I really admire on his own, and also he picked up and it's became the one who continued the Robert B. Parker series, the one that so many people love, featuring Jesse Stone. And of course, it's also a television series that comes up every once in a while when they decide to put one together. And so it's so much fun to be able to talk to read. Farrell Coleman, who has picked up the mantle and carried on with the Robert B. Parker story. So I'll be talking to him in a few minutes. I just want to remind everyone again, please, if you're looking for an agent, go to Publishers Weekly, check their there's a listing there under Book Deals of the Week, and there you will find active agents. I was just talking to an author yesterday who is very frustrated. He sent out a whole bunch of query letters, and he sent them to people whose names he found in a book. And of course, he never heard from most of them, because if the name is in a book, it means the book had to be published at least 18 months earlier, or put together 18 months earlier than published a year earlier, if it's up to date. By the time you get it, half of those people are gone. They are not agents anymore. They've taken salary jobs, because you remember, agents make their money based on percentage. And so they have to be a real, sometimes authors get mad at agents, and having gone through it, I have felt that same way. But actually, it is a very difficult job, because agents they might get a little base salary, but they basically make their money on percentage. And so it is hard work. It's just like for any salesman on the road, it's hard work. And after a few years, most, I would say, I think a lot, maybe 50%, just give it up. And they take a job with one of the publishing firms so that they can, have a salary that comes in every week or every month nowadays. And so it's funny that I was talking to this author, and he said, I wrote these letters, I sent them all out. And he did was change the name on the when he printed it out or sent it out now, I guess, in email form. But that doesn't work. It really doesn't work. You're just frustrating yourself, making yourself crazy, because many times these people are long gone. And if they haven't taken a job in New York City, they've gone back home to their home states and gotten married, and they're having children and trying to forget the years that they didn't make any money in New York City. So please only use Publishers Weekly. Look at active agents who are making deals. That's how you find it. And so, as I said, this is really important. I get so sad, really, when I hear these stories about people who they think they've tried enough, and you haven't, because it's amazing how many authors have told me that they have, gotten a deal based on their 57th query. Only one author I know of who actually, and this is true because she proved it to me, but I can't say her name because she doesn't want people to know. She got her deal based on one is read on. Oh, my goodness. Reed.
Yes.
I was waiting for you. Hi, I didn't realize you were on.
Yes.
Okay, well, so I am so happy to talk to you about the bitterest pill. Wow. It's funny. I was talking to C.J. Box, who did the also a book with the word bitter in it. And I get these every once in a while. I get these sort of things where I get the same word in a title. So when I got this one, and I said the bitterest pill, and I got it, and of course it's Robert B. Parker's The Bitterest Pill, and I was so thrilled that I got this book, because you are so, you know, I've been asked to talk to a lot of people who are carrying on a series for an author who's passed on, and really most of them never get into the character like you do, and you have Jesse, so you have captured him so well over the, now this is your eighth book, right, of the 18?
Sixth
book of the 18. You have captured him so well, and I was really thrilled. What I was thrilled about is that as we've gone along through the books, I found that you know, you stepped in there, and you brought Jesse to us, and in such a way that we really felt the continuation of the story. And I was real. And one of the things that thrilled me actually was that Jesse moved to a condo. Somehow, I didn't want him to continue living in this. Well, I think I didn't want the day that if you ever decide to kill him off, that you're going to kill him in the house. I have an affection, you know. I feel affection for the house, and I didn't want him to die there. So I think you will probably carry on, maybe until he's going into to care, you know, a care facility, because you keep telling the story so well.
I suspect Jesse will outlive me.
Oh, you know, you are so good in this new story, and I love that you have brought in a son. You know, it puts a whole new slant on the story, and gives us a new look at Jesse, who's now not drinking. You know, it's so funny when you're reading a book about a guy who's drinking, all the time you want him to stop drinking. And then when he stops drinking, you're worried about all the time that he's going to start drinking. And you've captured that feeling. I mean, that's how real. I think this is the beauty of your writing. You make Jesse so real. We are really caring about whether he's going to, you know, pick up a bottle again.
Well, you know, one of the things I've always said is, you know, you've done a good job when people think about, readers think about the character after they close the book.
Oh,
and the point for me always is, look, I just finished the book. You close the book, you forget the plot. But if the character lives on, you've done a good job. The writer's done a good job. And that's what I feel. If people close one of my books or one of the books in the Stone series, and they are thinking about Jesse, caring about Jesse, worrying about what happens to him, then I've done a good job.
And I am. I'm worried about the house. I'm worried about, you know, does he like living in the condo? I have so many of these things that continue. It's so funny. But, of course, that's because you are a brilliant writer. And I think I mentioned last time when you won, well, I can't, you know, list all of the awards that you've been nominated for, but you've won so many, and of course you've been nominated for the Anthony, the Audie, the Barry, the Gumshoe, the Edgar. You are like a real magnet there for nominations, right? And of course you've won so many of them too, and it's always so wonderful to read your work. I remember when you came out with the Gus Murphy series. Well, I heard it was just two books. I'm hoping that it's more, because I really like that. But with the new book, it's also a very timely book. You know, the new book is, when you're talking about the bitterest pill, you really have a story here. So tell us about this story for this book, and how did you come out with this? Because, as I said, it's something that people are thinking about.
Oh, I think the seed of the book was planted when I did an interview with my friend and world-renowned author Don Winslow. And I was interviewing him in Bryant Park, which is next to the New York Public Library. And it was out in public, and it was filmed, and it was a public interview. And no one knows more about the drug crisis and the drug cartels than Don Winslow does. And he said something that had a profound impact on me. And it's the opening quote in the book, which is, "We declared war on drugs 50 years ago. We spent $1 trillion on it. And drugs are cheaper, more available, and more potent than they ever were. If this is victory, I would hate to see defeat." And that has stuck in my head ever since he said that. And I was thinking, you know, I'm not a theme writer. It's not like I said, oh, this book is going to be about the opioid crisis. The last book was about white supremacy. It's about, what if I introduce these issues into Jesse's town, and how will Jesse react to them? So I thought, wow, Jesse's got a son. What if, and he's a new father, he's always been able to insulate himself from tragedies because he's no longer married and he never had kids. So as loving and as empathetic and as kind as Jesse is, he's always been able to somewhat keep himself at arm's length from tragedies, especially to children. But what if Jesse was a father, and the victim in this case was a 17-year-old girl he'd known his whole life who used heroin and died of an overdose in her bedroom? How would Jesse react? So that was the kernel of the book. So it was a combination of Don Winslow saying that to me during an interview and of me thinking, now that Jesse's a father, how would he react to a crime that involves, you know, a child?
Well, you certainly, you know, as I said, I love the introduction of the son. By the way, you named him Cole Slayton.
Right.
You know, when you think about Jesse, and as you said, over the years, we sort of wanted things to work out for him. We were sad that he didn't have children. We were sad that he had bad relationships that didn't work out. And so introducing Cole, I think, was a bit of genius here.
Thank you. I thought it was a good idea, too.
So tell us about how that came about. How did you decide to bring in Cole?
Well, one of the things about a long-running series, is they get stale. And now I'm not saying that the Jesse Stone series got stale, but it got, in some ways, for me, I didn't want to keep repeating the same thing over and over again. So when I took the series over, for which I'm very thankful, when I took the series over, I thought, you know, the series isn't stale, but if I keep writing, you know, Jesse getting drunk and Jesse regretting getting drunk and Jesse having bad relationships with women, it would get stale. So I thought, and if you read my other books, you know, I don't have static characters. I don't have static protagonists. For instance, Mo Prager aged over the course of the 9 books. Even Gus Murphy in 2 books, his life is changing. So I don't believe in static characters. So I thought, well, I can't really change Jesse. You know, that I can't make him a different character than who he's been in the 12 books before I took over. But what I can do is change circumstances. I can change Paradise a little. I can make him have better relationships with women, even though he's still who he is. And I thought, wow, wouldn't it be just amazing if he stopped drinking And all of a sudden, he stops drinking, and a wrench gets thrown into his life. A completely unexpected thing gets thrown into his life. And what I thought, what would that best be? And it would be an unknown child. And not a happy unknown child. A child who resents and is angry at him. Now, I don't want to give too much
away. Yeah, don't give too much away, because it's. I love the way that it develops. I love the way that you bring it out. And the funny thing is, and this is one of the things that will keep people turning the pages, because they're going to want to know what's going to happen with Cole. And again, we hope nothing. It's a way that you get us so into the characters that we really care so much about them, you know, whether it's Molly or whether we do. And I will tell you, this is the first book where I realized Paradise was so close to Boston. Somehow, in my mind, it was like away from the Boston problems. But you have, you know, really shown the encroachment, so that for the first time, I used to think when Jesse went off to Boston, it was like a big trip, you know. And now I realize that it was right there all the time.
Well, that was one of the things that I did. I have to say, I changed about the series from when Bob and Michael did it, was that they wrote it kind of as an isolated place from Boston, so that it was kind of its own world. And to me, the world is too interconnected for that to be the case anymore. For instance, I live 40 miles outside New York City on Long Island. And, you know, someone once said being in Canada was like sleeping next to an elephant, because if it rolls over, you know, just because you're next door and, you know, you're on the border. So being close to a big city or a big country, you can't be isolated anymore. So I thought, well, maybe we should let Boston and Paradise is based on Marblehead, which is really not that far away from Boston. I thought, you know, it's time to introduce something into the series where Boston plays a bigger role in the series.
Exactly. Well, that's why I say you're such a great writer, because you do keep it fresh. And I'm not going to mention the series, but, you know, it's wonderful. This is my program, so I don't have to accept every author if I don't like the book. And there's a series, and somebody picked it up, and they've been writing quite a few books. But they're almost all the same story of the author who passed on. And, it, you know, the same story, a different girl maybe every time, but, you know, the same story. And that's why with what you've done and I'm sure that, Robert B. Parker's estate is so happy with you, because you write books that people want to read, want to continue the storyline, and you've done a terrific job.
Well, it's it's difficult when you pick up someone else's series. Like, let's just say we'll use Stieg Larsson's series, the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo series. There are certain things now that the gentleman who's taken over the series repeats over and over. And I'm not saying that that's the series you're referring to. It probably wasn't. But I find that, okay, so Lisbeth Salander always has to go after abusive men. So every book, you know, she goes after an abusive man. It has to somehow be connected to her path, her father. And that, to me, as a writer, I don't want to have to check off boxes. Well, I have to do this, and I have to do that. And to me, that's boring. But, you know, some readers like Meatloaf. Like, I like Meatloaf, but I don't want to have it for dinner every day.
Exactly. And that's why your books are so outstanding, and why everybody loves all of your books. Because, as I said, when you came out with the Gus Murphy, the two books there, you were on the program, and I remember we were talking about Where It Hurts and how you came out with that idea. And it's you know, it's a talent. And I know that, you know, you are so much admired in the community. And I think, are you going to BoucherCon this year?
I'm definitely going to Dallas. I wouldn't miss it.
Okay, well, I'm going to be there.
Oh, excellent.
Oh, because we lived in Texas a long time, so I have my cowboy hat, and it's going to be a glitz and glamour one, so I'm going to be a rhinestone cowboy. I asked CJ Box if he would come and put rhinestones on his cowboy hat, which he always wears, but he said no. He can't make it, and he won't put rhinestones on his hat.
Well, I'm Brooklyn born and bred, but I will be there with my lizard skin cowboy boots.
Good. Well, that's good. Well, I'll look forward to seeing you, and you can look forward to seeing me. I'm going to have my on my cowboy hat. I'll have my name, Patsy with a Z, and so you'll be able to recognize me. And and I hope that you know, we can get together and talk a little bit more, because you. As I said, I admire your work so much, and I think I don't know what are you working on? Are you going to do another Gus Murphy? Are you going to do something else?
I'm working on the prequel sequel novel to the movie Heat with Michael Mann.
Ooh!
And I'm writing a new character, a new series character for Blackstone Publishing, and the first book should be out in. Sometime in late 2020.
Wow, so. that's fantastic. Well, you're going to be at BoucherCon 2019 in Dallas, and the new book is called Robert B. Parker's The Bitterest Pill, Jesse Stone, number 18. And what is your website so people can go and have a look at it?
Very simple, reedcoleman.com.
Okay, and so did you name Cole Slayton? After yourself?
Well, no. I named Cole Slayton to sort of Cole and Slate. So he's kind of a cold, and you know, when he's first introduced, he's kind of got a big chip on his shoulder.
Like a block of ice.
Right. So the name is kind of icy and distant, and that's why I named him that.
Okay. Well, people can go to your website, as you said, they can see more about you and a list of your books and your awards and everything. And it was just a joy to talk to you today, Reed. And I look forward to seeing you in at the end of October. Okay.
Okay. Thank you for having me on, Patsy with a Z.
Okay. Bye bye now.
Bye.
All right. We're going to go to commercial, and then we'll be back. And I have a very fascinating book called The Secret Empress.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell. Or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back. Okay, well, I've been having a, I did a taping of an interview, which I will play in a few days, probably next week, because I had the opportunity to talk to Sharon Robinson. So I taped the interview earlier, and it was very emotional for me because I really admire her so much. And of course, being a big baseball fan, her father, Jackie Robinson, was always somebody that we talked about, and I admired him so much. So I'm really thrilled that I got to tape it. And after I finished taping, I invited her to come on the program for an hour so that I can talk to her about all her books and more about her dad. And in a minute, I'm going to be talking to Frank R. Heller, and he's written a book called The Secret Empress, which is about set in Hong Kong. And when I talked to Sharon Robinson, we mentioned there about the Children's March in Birmingham and how relevant it is to today's situation in Hong Kong. So I was really happy when I got this book and the opportunity to talk to somebody who knows the area and knows the situation. And so I'm happy to welcome to the program Frank R. Heller, and we're talking about The Secret Empress, his new book. And I'm really thrilled to have you on the program, Frank.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. Okay, well, you know, it's this is a book that comes out just at the right time, I think, because everybody's eyes are focused on Hong Kong. And so that you have such in-depth knowledge and that you've written this fascinating book called The Secret Empress. By the way, I love the cover. I the minute I got it, I just had to put it right at the top of the stack of books that I have. I have a big...
I love that.
Because I just love looking at the cover. So, Frank, tell us about The Secret Empress and tell us your relationship to Hong Kong, because things are going crazy over there, and I'm looking forward to hearing your opinion.
First of all, I have to tell you, there's an ancient Chinese curse that goes, "May you live in interesting times." And I think that bears out what's going on right now. My first exposure to Hong Kong was when I was in the U.S. Navy in 1964. We arrived on an extended liberty on Christmas Eve, the morning of Christmas Eve in 64. What was going on then in Hong Kong was the disparity between the immense wealth and the horrible poverty, particularly in the shanty towns of the New Territories, was incredibly striking for a 17-year-old going way back then. That was a long, long time ago. The change since then has been so remarkable. Hong Kong has become almost a place of golden wealth for all of Asia. To see what is going on today is frightening. And I'm sure it's frightening for the Chinese government as well, because they're walking a very thin line. They have to be very careful with what they're doing. And I think that's borne out by the restraint that they've exhibited in not cracking down more severely. I was in Canton for the Canton Fair when the Tiananmen Square demonstrations first began. That was in 89. And we were there for the fair. The people at the fair, when these demonstrations started, were very excited by what was happening. There was a sense of hope. This was going to change some of the things happening in China. And people were excited. As the crackdowns came into being and the demonstrations slowly waned, you saw the faces change. The curtain came down and you got blank faces. People were not talking about anything. They refused to comment. And it went back underground. So it's that turn of page that we're looking not to find in Hong Kong right now. The demonstrators are walking a tightrope of their own because they have to push the Chinese government to get the freedoms that they want. They have to be careful not to push too far so that they escalate it into a Tiananmen Square kind of tamp down. And I think that's what we're seeing.
And as I said, because your book is about, it's a fascinating story. And I'll let you, I don't know how much you want to tell about it. I think that I always love, you know, turning the pages and not knowing everything that's going to happen in advance. But tell us about the story, about the character, Joe Wilder, who goes to Hong Kong because he has a successful bodybuilding company, and
Joe Wilder started out life as a competitive bodybuilder. He was a Mr. Universe, a Mr. Olympia, 7-time champion, and when he retired from bodybuilding, he built a conglomerate that encompassed bodybuilding equipment, exercise, gymnasiums, the publishing of 7 different magazines devoted to bodybuilding and good health. He manufactures and distributes food supplements, and all of a sudden he's hit with a new contract for everything that he buys from China that carries with it a 30% price increase. Anyone in business knows that a 30% cost increase puts you out of business. He is invited to come to the Canton Fair to renegotiate his contracts with the Deputy Minister of Trade for Guangdong Province, which is where his factories are. In so doing, the deputy minister offers him a sweetheart deal, one of those things that's too good to believe. And coupled with that offer, she asks for a small favor. That small favor turns out to be a 12-year-old child that she wants Joe to help get to the United States. She doesn't want him to smuggle the child out of China, but to help. What happens is, all of a sudden, that deputy minister is murdered. Joe finds himself the prime suspect in that murder, also the sole caretaker for that 12-year-old child, and the target of the largest criminal organization in China that's hunting for Joe and the child.
In other words, all hell breaks loose. And
he wakes up in the morning and wonders what the hell he got himself into.
Exactly. And we have an exciting story because Joe has a background. He was a CIA field agent, and so he knows how to deal with things, but he has quite a handful here to deal with.
Coupled with that, part of the backstory, when Joe retired from being a field agent, part of the reason was he stumbled into a terrorist attack in a department store in Paris, solely by accident. In doing so, he was able to save almost all of the children who had been taken hostage, all except one. And it's that memory of that dead child that he was holding in his arms that he could not save that drives him into taking on this responsibility.
Of trying to save this Chinese boy and get him to America.
Exactly. And it's the memory of that child that he couldn't save that drives him forward to save this one.
And he goes through a lot. It's an exciting book.
It also takes us on a travelogue throughout China, which is also fun.
And the interesting thing is, people don't know enough about China. We hear it in the news all the time, but the truth is most Americans have little idea of what China was like, is like, and so I think any time that they will read a book like this, and I think the nice thing about this book, it's compelling. It's the kind of book that you see it and you say, I want to read it, first of all, just because of the cover, and the title is intriguing. And it has lots of spies and conspiracies and everything you could want in a thriller, and very well written. And I must say also, I love the layout, the internal layout, because sometimes, you know, a book really is something when you have it in your hand, particularly when the layout is great. Whether it's a chapter, the headings, the book is just a delight to read.
Thank you. I'm glad you saw it that way. The Secret Empress had an incredible genesis. I wrote it originally as a five-page treatment for a movie, which I sold to a film company 18 years ago.
Been there, done that.
No, they promptly did nothing with it.
No, I know. When I say been there, done that, that happened to me. I used to. Oh, boy.
Anyway, so the rights came back to me. I pulled it out 4.5 years ago and turned the five pages into a 65-page short story. And I gave it to a literary agent here in Los Angeles who loved it and said, okay, now write the novel.
Good.
I have four granddaughters. And when you sit down to a computer and you attempt to get into that page and to get the mindset of your story, and somebody climbs up on your lap and says, Poppy, can we look at pictures on the computer? It shortens your writing time. And so it took me 4.5 years to finish. In the meantime, my agent passed away. So it took me quite a while to find a publisher and to get the book published. But it's been fun.
Well,
you commented about the cover. You know, there is a very beautiful imperial throne in the Forbidden City. It's known as the Dragon Throne. And this was the seat of power for 600 years in China. So my original intent was to put an image of the Dragon Throne on the cover. After all, we're talking about the Empress, right? My granddaughter, who is now 10, read the manuscript when she was 8, and there is a great deal of conversation in the story about the Imperial Guard, known as the Dragon's Claw. And she said, the story's about the Dragon's Claw. What do you want to put an old chair on the cover of your book? Put a dragon on it.
Oh.
And the dragon.
Well, hence a beautiful cover. It really is. And, you know, so how many times have you been to China?
Oh, once a year for 35, 40 years.
Wow. So you've seen the change over the years. And, you know, one of the books that I recommend to particularly the younger generation to read or to listen to, because it's a hefty book. Unlike this one, I'm almost saying it's not long enough, but it's just long enough to tell a great story, is the John Halliday, Mao, The Unknown Story, which really puts into perspective the entire period of time when Mao was in charge and how the Chinese think. And so I think that any book that will bring people to take a look at China, try to understand it, because it's hard to understand, isn't it?
It's very, very difficult to understand. But the history of China is monumentally complex and fascinating all at the same time. One of the things that I uncovered in my research was the history of the Opium Wars, you know, which is fascinating because I think we can blame the British Empire for the illicit drug trade in far Asia that dates back to the 1840s. Great Britain was importing tea and Chinese export dishes, all kinds of things from China at that time. And the government they were paying in silver bullion. They wanted China to accept part of the payment in opium because they had all of these colonies that were producing opium. And they insisted. China refused. So they began smuggling opium into China. And that triggered the first Opium War of 1842. Unfortunately, China lost that war. So Great Britain began paying for all of their imports from China, half in silver, half in opium. And suddenly the Chinese Empire found itself with opium dens scattered all over the country. They finally decided that this was the wrong thing to do, and they started attacking the British stores of opium, mostly in Kowloon and in Canton. That started the Second Opium War. They lost that one, too. And in 1860, they entered into a peace treaty with Great Britain, and that gave Great Britain the New Territories and Hong Kong, and ultimately all of Kowloon for 100 years. They just gave that back in 1998. So that history, when you delve into it, you understand some of the machinations of why China behaved in certain ways, why they closed their territories to the Western world for so many years, because they were concerned about that.
And there are just so many, many things that, as you said, you've been to China over many years. So that's going back to a long time ago. And you've seen the change within the country.
The change within the last 40 years is monumental. When we first started manufacturing cabinet hinges in China, our factories would call periodically and say, I'm sorry, the shipment's going to be delayed. We ran out of our allotment of electricity. Now, think about that for a moment. Can you imagine an American factory calling its customer and saying, we ran out of electricity? We can't produce your product? They had problems then of the electrical and telephone lines being sabotaged because people would steal the copper and sell it on the black market. Contrast that with today, where China has created the free economic zone along the eastern seaboard of the country, and they allowed private enterprise, private ownership of both property and business. They created millionaires and billionaires all along that area. Now the factories call and say, we can't ship on time. We don't have enough workers to produce your product. They used to have dormitories for the workers on site at the factories. Now the workers are leaving the factories, they're leaving the farms, they're going to the big cities for higher paying jobs. So look at that dichotomy. That's what China is faced with today.
So what do you think about Hong Kong? What do you think is going to happen?
What I think or what I hope?
Oh.
What I hope is that they come to a resolution and that China allows the status quo of Hong Kong. Hong Kong has spent 100-plus years being a free society. They don't have the mindset of a communist nation. It's very difficult for them to accept all of the rules and regulations of communist China. If China attempts to impose that, they're going to run into a terrible, terrible quagmire, and it's going to be a bloodbath. And the flip side of that is that Hong Kong is the financial center of all of Asia. Probably two-thirds of every financial transaction that happens in Asia goes through Hong Kong. If China crushes that, they lose that financial center, they lose that access to the financial stream from all over the world. And that's part of their thinking and what they're doing with the demonstrators. So it's a problem.
It is. They're going to have to come to some resolution, because I certainly the people of Hong Kong are not going to accept the idea of being extradited to China mainland. Nobody wants to be extradited to China mainland.
No, certainly not for a crime that they may or may not have committed. But that's off the table. The governor of Hong Kong has rescinded that, and that's no longer in question. But all of the other restrictions are. So, you know, the demonstrators are still pushing for a free society. So like the man said, may you live in interesting times.
Exactly. And may people read this book and
oh, please.
Absolutely. And it's called The Secret Empress by Frank R. Heller. And probably, Frank, now that it's a published book and it's back out there in Los Angeles, in wild Los Angeles, somebody will option it again, and somebody will maybe actually film it, or it'll go and turn around and then be optioned again. And sometimes you can make money just being optioned all the time. But hopefully it will actually turn into film, because I think it would make a fascinating film. And it really has action. Just right from the beginning, right from the prologue, we have a little very intriguing beginning. And I think that it would make, obviously, you've thought about it and you've written it very cinematically.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
It's going to be fun.
Hopefully people will look for it. It's on Amazon. It's available on a number of other booksellers online. I had my first book signing at Barnes & Noble at the Grove here in Los Angeles on August 5th, which was really daunting because I was afraid that I couldn't fill the room. Fortunately, it was overflowing, and Barnes & Noble sold out almost all of the softcover, and they sold out all of the hardcover.
Wow, that's fantastic.
So that was a lot of fun.
That's great news. Now, your publicist, you have a good publicist.
I do. I'm very lucky.
Kim, right?
Yes.
Kim. She is my favorite publicist, by the way, because
mine too.
What she does is, unlike, you know, I get a dozen books a week now, and they send them to me. They come in a envelope. There's a little piece of paper in there that says, these are the questions you should ask the author, and that's it. And they never. Kim, she writes a personal note. She makes sure that she has an envelope that's got big Kim across the whole thing, so that I know that it's from her. And then she tells me, Patsy, I think you will like this book. I know you will like this book. This is just the kind of book that you want.
Okay, Patsy, I've got to tell you what I get on my side, just for your edification. I have probably 5 pages here. And I've got all of your information, and I've got all about the show, Joy on Paper.
She's incredible. No other publicist does this. I'm telling you, she is absolutely incredible, and she's done such a wonderful job with you, and that's why your signing was filled, because it doesn't happen that often. I can tell you, I talk to a lot of writers, and that doesn't happen. So it means that she's out there, she's working it, and she's done a great job for you. I want everybody to get the book, and then in about with the turnaround and everything. But perhaps in 2 years we'll have this. We'll see it on Netflix or what's the other one? Amazon Prime, right?
Absolutely. And sometime toward the end of next year, the sequel will be out.
Okay. Well, you're going to be on the program again. And as I said, it is a very exciting book, a very timely book. It'll start getting people thinking a little bit more about China. And the more we think about it, the more we know, the more we can hopefully understand what's going on over there. But I look forward to having you on next year, and give those grandchildren a whole pile of books to keep them busy reading. Don't put them on some silly game, electronic game. Give them books. And
no, they're not allowed.
Good. And I'll have you back next year, okay?
I look forward to it. Thank you very
okay,
much.
Okay, is there a website people should go to for you?
They can. The website is www.thesecretempress.com.
Okay.
And they can also follow me on Facebook.
Okay. Well, it's a great title, The Secret Empress. Right there, it's intriguing. And as I said, it is a really great read. So thank you, Frank R. Heller, for being on Joy on Paper today. It was a joy to talk to you.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye. Take care.
All right. Well, as I was saying, this is a fascinating book. I love it, actually. I had lots of fun reading it. And you will, too. And as I said, Kim from L.A. is the publicist, and she's wonderful. And I, again, want to give the name of the book that I think you should listen to. Probably you won't want to read, especially the hardback. It's so heavy. It's called Mao, The Unknown Story. And it's by John Halliday and Yang Chang. And it really takes you into the China during Mao's time. And it helps you to understand how the Chinese think and what the Chinese are capable of doing and why we should pay attention to China in general, and I think you will enjoy it. It is a really, really great Audible book. It's available on Audible, and it's as I said, the book is very long, but when you listen to the Audible, it just flows so quickly. You at the end, you say, "Oh, well, that wasn't very long." Although I think it's maybe 23 hours, but it's worth every minute, and you will enjoy it. So do that, and then Frank just mentioned Facebook. I don't mention it enough. I have to do more Facebook. I have to do it. You can go to my Radio Joy on Paper Facebook page and like me there. And I put up the different interviews I have, and those are up on my webpage, which is radio-joy on paper. And I'm going to put up this interview. And so I'm really excited about when I can find a spot for Sharon Robinson's. I was fully booked, but for Sharon Robinson, I just had to speak to her today, and because I was just so honored to have her on the program. And as I said, being a big Detroit Tigers fan and baseball fan in general, really, people, what are you doing out there asking baseball to, you know, make it go faster? One of the joys of my childhood was when we had a baseball game. I think we went to 11 innings, and it was like 5 hours or something, and maybe five. And I loved it. It was so much fun. It was so exciting to have a game go that long. So I don't know why people are complaining. It's a crazy trend that they just want to speed everything up so they can get more commercials in. You know, they want, you know, 60 minutes of a golf game or a baseball game, they want to have 20 minutes of commercials. They're getting on my nerves. Some of these games, you just can't rush the players. They have to think. They have to think about what they're doing. You know, I hate when they're rushing. Unless it's a race, a horse race, there you can rush these horses and you can rush the runners, but leave baseball and golf alone, okay? And remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an Audible book, or if you're very lucky, to hear those words, and they are magical. Lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, a streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I hope one day Carol J. Perry's series, Witch City Mysteries, will be on the Hallmark Channel, because they need something new. I'm tired of repeats. My goodness, they have enough money. Buy Carol J. Perry's series, and you'll have a wonderful, wonderful program to run. I mean, you want to say something nice to somebody today? I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room very fast, because he's so wonderful, and he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him, and I have to get out of here because we're running out of time. It's been a great day. Okay, bye-bye now.